Okay, a few ground rules before we begin. First, don't swim too far out to sea. Second, keep an eye on your air supply. And third, don't stick your fingers in places where they don't belong. You will live to regret it. Welcome to the Backpacker's Guide to Prehistory. And welcome to the Backpacker's Guide to Prehistory, the podcast that provides top travel tips for time travelers. I'm your tour guide, David Mountain. In this episode, we're exploring the Cambrian, stretching from 541 to 485 million years ago. The Cambrian is as far back as most commercially available time machines will take you. We are at the dawn of the Paleozoic era. We're at the dawn of the entire Phanerozoic eon, for that matter. And, most importantly, we're at the dawn of some of life's biggest, boldest, and weirdest experiments. It might lack the star power of the Mesozoic or the familiarity of the Ice Age, but a trip to the Cambrian is a holiday like no other. Understandably, a lot of people are hesitant about visiting the Cambrian, not only because it's so long ago, but because the Earth and its life forms are so different to what we're used to today. The continents are unrecognizable. Florida is at the South Pole and Siberia is a tropical island. And there are entire orders of organisms that simply do not exist today. As a result, it can be hard to make sense of what you're seeing on your trip. So, to guide me through the tangled tumble of teeth and tentacles, I've got two Cambrian experts to help me out. Dr. Martin Smith, a paleontologist at Durham University.
Hello!
And Dr. Xiaoya Ma, a paleontologist at the University of Exeter.
Hello!
Before Martin and Xiaoya share their travel advice, however, we need to talk a little bit about safety. And the most immediate danger you'll encounter in the Cambrian isn't any predator, it's not even any natural disaster. Instead, it's the very air you breathe. 500 million years ago, there aren't any real land plants, so there's much less photosynthesis. Consequently, oxygen levels are about 3/4 of what they are today. Even more worrying, carbon dioxide levels are about 20 times higher than they are today. So a supply of oxygen is a must. Otherwise, you're very quickly going to succumb to hypercapnia, or excessive CO2 in the bloodstream, and you'll spend your holiday drowsy and breathless, and it just won't be any fun. Having sorted that out, it won't be long into your trip before you notice another odd thing about the Cambrian. We discussed this previously when we explored the Devonian period, and it's that the passage of time in the Paleozoic is noticeably different to the present day. This is because the Earth's spin, the movement which makes the sun appear to move across the sky, that spin has gradually been slowing over time. So, the further back in time you go, the faster our planet was spinning, and the shorter its days were. A day in the Cambrian, which remember is about 500 million years ago, was around 21.5 hours long, and there were about 420 of these days in a Cambrian year. There's nothing you can do about this, of course. So my only real piece of advice here is to ignore whatever the sun's doing and just sleep when you're tired. If you try and set your days by the sun, your body clock's going to get horribly confused, and the Cambrian will make even less sense than it already does. Right then, once you've got your breathing apparatus set up and you've thrown away that useless 24-hour watch, you're ready to discover everything that the Cambrian has to offer. Only, when you take your first steps in the Cambrian, it might seem like it's got nothing to offer at all. I'm standing on the western shore of Gondwana, the largest continent in the Cambrian. And it's a pretty desolate shoreline. Apart from the sound of the waves, it's absolutely silent. There are no bird calls, no animal noises, not even the scuttle of insects. and looking around, there's not a shred of life to be seen. The beach is empty, and the land behind me is bare rock and sand. Martin, was there anything living on land in the Cambrian?
Yeah, I'm not sure that tourists in the Cambrian really want to be going to stay on the land. It's not exactly the most exciting place for you and for me. And it's kind of hard to see what's going on there. Yeah, there's nothing really big enough or hard enough to leave any sensible fossils. So there's some indication there's probably some fungi starting to form the very first soils and starting to break down and weather the rocks. But you're not really going to see a huge deal of action on the surface. Yeah, if you're really excited in pond scum, maybe you could go to an inland freshwater lake and you'd see something blue and murky floating on the surface. But otherwise, really, the oceans are the place to go if you want to get seeing something exciting in the Cambrian.
All right. So if we want to experience the Cambrian in all its bamboozling glory, we're going to have to head beneath the waves. Welcome aboard the Morella, this podcast's very own submersible. I'm on the hunt for the animal communities of the Cambrian seas. So, Martin and Xiaoya, now that we're out at sea, whereabouts in the world is best if we want to find diverse communities of animals? Are we talking the tropics or mid-latitudes? Or do we simply not know?
Most of the land in the Cambrian is at the tropics, and so most of the fossils that survive to the present day come from that sort of environment, although it's a little bit hard to pin down whereabouts the continents were back in the Cambrian. So Africa, South America were possibly down as far as the South Pole, possibly a little bit further north. But yeah, as today, it seems that there is a high diversity of life at the tropics.
From our current evidence, it shows quite a lot of these biotopes, like very rich in animals. They are pretty much distributed within 20 degrees from the equators. So when you go to a very tropical, hot environment.
So it sounds like we need to chart a course for warm, tropical waters.
Yeah.
One of the most exciting destinations for people visiting the Cambrian is the Zhenjiang biota. Now today, of course, this is in China, but back in the Cambrian, what was this environment like? What would it have looked like?
A lot of this biodiversity hotspot is around the equator, and there's a couple of the big supercontinents. One's Laurentia, so it's famous like Bergesia, and several was this supercontinent called Gondwana. It was early forming of the Gondwana supercontinent. But in between these big two supercontinents, there's a microcontinent, and one of the microcontinents is called the South China microcontinent. And a lot of very, very interesting Cambrian biotopes are formed around the edge of this South China microcontinent.
What types of organisms can you see in the Zhenjiang biota? What's the diversity like there?
So we have about over 230 species of different animals being discovered from the Zhenjiang biota. And they cross about 18 different animal phyla. So it is extremely diverse in both of the fossil numbers and also fossil species. So by the time in the Cambrian, it should be quite diverse of different type of animals.
Martin, how deep do we need to dive if we want to find these biotas, these rich animal communities? Should we be searching in shallow seas or deeper water?
Yeah, there's life certainly in the shallows and certainly going down to a reasonable depth, sort of tens of metres. Yeah, that's again tends to be where most of the rocks that are going to leave fossils will tend to be in those shallower settings. And there's not a great deal of evidence for much life going on deep in the oceans. And what is worth appreciating is that the deep oceans are not particularly hospitable places in the Cambrian. Even the shallow oceans get pretty low on oxygen. There's all sorts of nasty sulfides and chemicals. The oceans don't seem to be as well mixed as they are today in terms of oxygen getting down really deep. If you're at a couple of hundred metres depth, you might have a community that's surviving, that's flourishing, that's doing quite well, and then suddenly there's a bit of a hiccup or a belch from deeper in the oceans, the oxygen runs out, the poisons come in, and splat, that's the end of that.
If you want to find diverse marine communities in the present day, a good place to search are reefs. Now, my guidebook here says that reefs had already evolved by the Cambrian, but that they're not the same ones that we're familiar with today. So, what should I be looking out for? What are the principal reef-building organisms of the Cambrian?
Yeah, well, reefs were very different, and they've changed quite a lot through geological time, but there certainly weren't many corals sitting around, certainly no skeletonized corals. For most of the duration of the Cambrian, reefs were made up of microbes. So walking around, yeah, if you trotted around on the seafloor, swimming over them, you just see sort of lumps and domes of, yeah, that sort of look like mud just splurted out onto the seafloor, slightly held together, maybe slightly furry and fuzzy. And, yeah, maybe some organisms walking over it. But you're not exactly going to get those beautiful, colourful pictures that you see over a coral reef today. There is a bit of an exception. If you go back to sort of just earlier than the middle of the Cambrian, we do see a very interesting and very distinctive reef community dominated by a type of sponge called archaeocyathes that sort of look like little goblets. I say little, yeah, sort of centimetres in size. But, yeah, they had really tough skeletons and they would form sort of, you know, interesting structures. And they look kind of, they're wonderfully geometric. And you could imagine Escher getting captivated by these sort of, they've got little holes in and little divisions inside them. And, yeah, they're really wonderful things to look at. And they might have been joined by other, you know, other sponges, other reef-building things. But, yeah, those reefs could get reasonably large. But for most of the Cambrian, you're looking at sort of, you know, more isolated and microbially dominated reefs that are really somewhere for an animal to live rather than something you want to go with the camera and photograph in their own right.
We've now reached one of these microbial reefs. And looking out the window, I'm going to be honest, I can't see much activity. But life is there. And I think one thing that backpackers need to prepare themselves for is that, by today's standards, a lot of animals back in the Cambrian were really quite small. So what's the typical size range for animals in the Cambrian?
Yeah, so most things in the Cambrian you could comfortably hold in your hand. A lot of the really marvellous creatures that look the most exciting are about the size of your fingernail, so really teeny stuff. But that's not to say there weren't some larger creatures. There's nothing that would quite be as big as a human, but there are some wonderful creatures. Anomalocaris is a famous example that grew up to a metre, maybe a bit more, in length. They weren't exactly ferocious. I wouldn't describe them as the great white sharks of the Cambrian. Yeah, they've got lovely big flaps running along the sides of their bodies, and they probably have gracefully swum through the oceans. Some were predatory, and some a little bit like whales today. You get killer whales, but you also get whales that filter feed. And even though these animals are much more closely related to lobsters and crabs than to mammals as whales are, they seem to have found that same solution to life's problems, that if you want to filter feed, you can get very big, you can get enormous plates that sort of go through the water and harvest out all of the little microbes that might be growing in it. And you can make yourself a living as the biggest creature in the Cambrian oceans, even if you're still not going to be as large as time-travelling humans going back to spy on you.
I'm interested by what you said about Anomalocaris just then, because I had always pictured this animal as a really fearsome predator. But given that humans are the biggest creatures around, would they have posed any danger to someone scuba diving or snorkeling among these Cambrian reefs?
I guess if you are swimming in the Cambrian Sea, you don't want to get too close to it because the animals typically have a pair of front appendages. So they are like us, for the appendage is really big and with a lot of spines from the appendage. So that is often being considered used for predatory and for grasping of the prey. And I don't think you want to be caught by that pair of appendage. And they often bring the food closer to their mouth.
Their mouth is a really strange thing that's sort of, you know, about the size of the palm of your hands. It looks like a pineapple ring, but each segment of the pineapple ring in the middle has got more teeth and more spines. And some of the relatives have got this whole stack of spines going right down the throat. It's a sort of a conveyor belt of death, essentially. Not very nice things if you're the size of a finger, but if you're the size of a human, then, well, maybe don't poke them in the mouth, but you should be okay.
There was an experiment done thinking they might bite some of the trilobite. So if they can crunch in through the exoskeleton of a trilobite, I'm sure they can crunch in through our bone as well. So I think some of them you don't want to swim too close to.
Ooh, yeah, because a trilobite, that's pretty tough, isn't it?
Yeah, because compared with some different arthropods, the trilobite's exoskeleton is often biomineralized. So they often contain the calcium. So a little bit like if you think about in the sea, we have a crab. The crab's shell is quite hard compared with some shrimp. So I guess that a lot of trilobites had a relatively hard shell among the arthropods.
It's been said 1,000 times, but I have to say it again. These animals are really weird. It's as if H.P. Lovecraft designed the Pokemon universe. However, just because they look unusual to our mammalian Holocene eyes, that's not to say that they're unrelated to animals around today. So I'm really interested to find out what extant groups of animals, so animals still alive in the present day, what extant groups were already represented in the Cambrian?
Yeah, so I guess different from the Ediacaran period, which is pre-Cambrian. Start from Cambrian, we actually can recognize these animals. So we can recognize these fossils. So for example, if you see arthropod, although they are extinct species, we can't have exactly the same species anymore, but they are very much looks like arthropod today. You know, they have a segmented body, they have exoskeleton, appendages, body might have a head section, thorax, and abdominal. So all of this sort of body plan very much like arthropod we see today. Some of them also with the sort of paleontological research and by phylogenetic analysis, we can look into how they exactly relate to different groups of arthropod. So we can know, oh, this is might be ancestor to the crustacean. So like lobsters, shrimps, this might be more closely related to arachnids, like spiders and that sort of thing. So they already not only looks like arthropod, they also show the key characters that might distribute to different arthropod group today. The reason I use arthropod as an example is because in Cambrian time, arthropod is already one of the, no, not one of them, it's the most dominated animal group in Cambrian. So in Chenjiang Bight, pretty much 50% of the specimens are arthropod. Although there's a little bit of taphonomic bias, preservational bias, maybe because they have exoskeleton, they better preserve. But in general, in ecologically, they are the dominating member in the Cambrian. But except arthropod, we also have a lot of worms. So some worms, which is very well known, called the preapolite worms. And the preapolite worms, they have this earthworm sort of body, but they classically had a spiny proboscis, so front of the mouth. The proboscis can evert out or withdraw into the body and as a way of the movement and also for prey some small animals. And the preapolite is very abundant and dominate in Cambrian communities. But today they still exist. They are independent phyla and there are about 19 species still living today. So for this group of animals, despite over 520 million years or even longer history, they haven't changed much in body plan either. They're very much like their ancestors. Except this is sort of a lot of worms, a lot of arthropod. We also see diversity of tinafore and also various cnidarian species, the early chordate, potentially like earliest vertebrate, and also great diversity of various sponges. But there is some of these sort of enigmatic groups, or there's some animals we just couldn't make sense with. So we still have a lot of debate among scientists. So we don't know where they exactly fit in the tree of animals. And there are some groups that are totally extinct today, like you mentioned, Anomocaris, because Anomocaris are not living today anymore, but they are very close relative to the arthropod today. So their body is not, they don't have a harder exoskeleton on the body, but they have exoskeleton on their front appendages. They show the joint morphology, segmented morphology on the front appendage. But they don't have appendage along the body. They have a flaps, which is for swimming. So they show some characters such as the compound eyes, the arthropodized front appendage looks like arthropod, but they are not quite arthropod yet. So in the phylogenetic analysis, they are one of the closest relative to arthropod today. And so they are on the way to arthropod, if that makes sense. Same as the lobopodians, like Holocygnia. So Holocygnia, which is first described by Simon Conway Morris from the Burgessia specimen, and by the time he made it upside down, which is a very classical scientific story. So it looks like have a lot of spines, sessile on the, say, bottom, and some weird tube, facing upwards. So it looks like a really weird, bizarre animal, and hence gave the name Holocygnia, like hallucination. But of course, later on, when the Holocygnian being discovered from the Chenjiang Bight, and then have a clearly head and structure, everything, Then Tibi turned around and realized that he was one of the Lobopodians. So Lobopodians, also a group, was entirely extinct today, but they are sort of in this typical transitional stage. They have a vermiform body, so worm-like body. They don't have an exoskeleton, but unlike worms, they actually have a pair of appendages, and that is the earliest working locomotory appendages. And then, of course, some of them have eyes. Some of them have spine skeletons on the back. So they are also, in the evolutionary history, they've been considered as ancestor to some today's arthropods, including Onychophora, also known as a velvet worm, and the tardigrada, which is known as a water bear, the ones that have been to space and can still survive and reproductive, and also arthropod. So Cambrian lobopodians likely gave rise to today's pan-arthropod we see.
Yeah, so almost everything that's alive today, you can trace back relatives in the Cambrian, and maybe they're not organisms you could place directly within the extant groups, but yeah, they certainly have a large subset of the components of the body plan. So yeah, we don't see fish that we'd really call fish, but we do see things with fins and with eyes and with the right sort of fish-like breathing apparatus, and they've got most of the components, but maybe not quite all of the components. I suppose the things that are closest to living groups in the Cambrian tend to be the arthropods, so that's relatives of the crabs and the lobsters, and also some of the mollusks, so snails and slugs, are starting to resemble their modern body plans. But of course, diversity and, you know, weird body forms keep on expanding through time. And yeah, the Cambrian things look weird to today's eyes, but hey, if you go snorkeling in the right place in the modern oceans, you see things that look really weird to today's eyes as well. There's a whole load of different ways you can exist. And that really takes off in the Cambrian, I think. And I suppose one of the reasons it's so celebrated is that it's perhaps one of the best known. You know, without the advantages of time travel, if you want to know what animals in the past look like, you're really dependent on them preserving in the fossil record. Most of the time what preserves is going to be shells, teeth, and you can sort of just about reconstruct an animal, but you never really know what the soft and squishy parts are. But the Cambrian is unique in the geological periods for the abundance of exceptional sites of preservation where you do see all of those soft bits that would otherwise never make it into the fossil record. And so we can get a much better view of the sorts of animals that were alive, what they looked like and how strange they were, yeah, just simply because we're able to reconstruct them.
Do we know why the Cambrian was so good at preserving the soft parts of animals? What was happening in this time period that allowed for such detailed fossilisation?
Yeah, well, that's a big question, and there's a lot we still don't understand about what's responsible for that soft part preservation. A lack of oxygen has been cited in the past, and I think that's probably quite a small component of the story. It seems there's something quite special about the sedimentary composition that's particularly suitable to inhibiting decay. And, you know, I think a lot of the peculiarities of the Cambrian can actually be explained through the lens of thinking about what mud is being washed into the ocean. We've said already that there's not a huge deal of plant life on land. And when plants start growing and their roots start breaking down the soil, then that really changes, yeah, the mud that's getting washed into the rivers and the character of the sediment. Yeah, the continents have not really been weathered in the Cambrian in the same way as they were later on. And so I think just as organisms are starting to get their roots into land and starting to weather the soil, I think that's starting to release strange clay minerals, strange muds that are getting into the oceans that are not only opening up new possibilities for preservation, but also potentially changing the chemistry of the ocean, changing what's possible to live, and very importantly, fertilising the oceans.
As amazing as this preservation of soft body parts is, one of the first things a backpacker in the Cambrian will notice about its creatures are the hard parts. A lot of animals have shells, exoskeletons, defensive spines, or something like that. And this isn't really something we see in earlier periods of prehistory. So why do hard parts become so important, so predominant in the Cambrian?
Yeah, well, this is another of those questions that it's a little bit tricky to give a single answer to. There's all sorts of things probably going on. One possibility is that it's just easier to form hard parts. Yeah, you've suddenly got lots more minerals in the ocean, and so you could even say it's a problem that those minerals could be toxic and you need to get rid of them somehow, and forming hard parts is a byproduct of that effect. So that's sort of a passive answer to the question. A more active and maybe more exciting answer is to say, well, you get hard parts because there are predators, there are things coming around to eat you and you've got to stave them off. And I think there's probably at least a kernel of truth in that. Although, yeah, predators weren't new in the Cambrian. There were a few creatures in the Ediacaran, the period before, that did form hard parts and formed reefs in some cases. And you can see in their sort of, you know, coral-like skeletons evidence of little holes where things seem to have bored through these shells and tried to suck at the sweet tissue underneath. So there probably were predators before the Cambrian, but that's not to say that the Precambrian was the same as the Cambrian. Yeah, things really take off in the Cambrian. And again, perhaps that comes to there being more food available, and so you can support larger populations of predators who are always lurking around the corner rather than just occasionally passing through on their way to the next meal.
All this diversity we see is, of course, a result of the Cambrian explosion, the name given to that relatively sudden profusion of life forms at the start of the Cambrian period. Xiaoya, we've touched on some of the things that might have increased biodiversity, but let's address this topic head on. What factors might have triggered the Cambrian explosion?
There was a loads of different hypotheses over the last hundreds of years. But generally, you can divide this reason to three parts. One part is the environment change. So around the early Cambrian or late Ediacaran time, the Earth is very active. We see a lot of formation of a supercontinent and the hydrothermal activity. And we still occasionally get hit by a comet. And all this sort of environment change might be the triggering fact. This sort of activity changes the seawater chemistry composition. So the pH level might change, temperature change, and also very importantly, oxygen level in the seawater change, and also like a salinity change, nutrition cycle change. All of this can be a very important triggering factor to affect how the animal, where they live and how they evolve, that sort of thing. Because after the environment change, another category of the triggering factor was about developmental or genetic effect, such as the rapid increase of the genomic novelties and the loss of gene or gain the gene, they might switch on or switch off certain genes, and that might produce new morphologies. Another third category, which is the ecological. Ecological, as we mentioned earlier, about the predatory. So when you start to have a predatory, you have essentially like arm race, and then someone grows the shell to protect them, and maybe another one have to grow some shark teeth to crack the shell. And also like a locomotory, the life start as maybe quite sessile, but then slowly they have locomotory appendages, and then you can start crawling, you can start to swim, and it start can go far. So a lot of this sort of increase in mobility and also dispersal. So they might go further away to explore new found land. Everywhere is empty. So wherever you go, you can start a new colony there.
That's a good point. I hadn't thought of that before.
Yeah.
I wonder whether there's a degree to which the answer is it takes time for life to get complicated. And, you know, it took a lot of evolutionary experiments and failures until the right mutation came along that started to allow life to get complicated. And, you know, when it did, life itself provides a lot of these feedback mechanisms that caused it to get more and more complicated. Once you start having small organisms eating plankton at the surface, well, those small organisms are big enough and heavy enough, they can sink to the bottom of the ocean before they dissolve. And so that means there's a food source at the bottom of the ocean, and so you can get animals living at the bottom of the ocean. And when you've got animals living at the bottom of the ocean, maybe they start burrowing to get into the sediment, to do whatever they do in their burrows, and those burrows start to churn up the sediment, and that gets oxygen into the sediment, and so suddenly the sediment's a nicer place to live. Some more animals live in the sediment. So then it's worth being a burrowing predator. And then if you've got a burrowing predator, maybe you can get a bigger predator that comes and preys on that one. And it's sort of a chain reaction that goes on and on, that life almost seems to create the conditions necessary to have more life. And I suppose you could think about a rainforest today, where actually, you know, you look at the rainforest and they're really, you know, low productivity places. There's the soil in the rainforest is really thin, but because there's such a huge diversity of life, that just creates more opportunities. And, you know, this particular species of flower gets pollinated by this particular species of beetle that gets eaten by this particular species of wasp. And, you know, the presence of the diversity almost continues to churn out more and more diversity. And yeah, we see similar things happening in other periods in Earth history. Yeah, the rise of the mammals is a really rapid thing. And yeah, you think when the dinosaurs went extinct, what have you got? A few little things scurry around looking like mice. And within 10 million years, you've got bats and giraffes and whales and all this range of diversity. And maybe it just doesn't stand out as much because we've already had the dinosaurs and there's already other things alive. And Yeah, the Cambrian, we really notice it because there was almost nothing at all. But suddenly, this first radiation stands out because it's really filling the stage for the first time.
A lot of guidebooks describe the creatures of the Cambrian explosion as evolutionary dead ends, which, to me, carries the implication that nature was just messing around before getting onto the serious matter of vertebrates and land animals. And I think that's unfair. I mean, none of these Cambrian animals are poorly adapted to their environment, are they?
Yeah, well, I guess dead end we see as being a failure, and in one sense it is. Is it 99% of species that have gone extinct? You know, 500 million years is a long time for a species to survive. So ultimately, we expect everything back then to be a dead end somewhere or another. But I guess the way that this becomes a negative term is it's the idea that somehow it got it wrong, it was a failed experiment, yeah, this is something that could never have worked. And actually, yeah, I wonder if you brought back a few little Cambrian beasties in a little collecting jar and released them in the oceans today, actually, would they instantly say, oh no, we're outcompeted, or would they be very good at making a life for themselves in the present day?
Well, I've had a great time exploring the slightly discombobulating world of the Cambrian. But before I bring the Morella back up to the surface, I'd like to ask both my guests for their one top recommendation for the Cambrian period.
Oh, wow. Narrowing it down to one is difficult. I think my top tip would be to take things slowly. I think, yeah, there were some pockets of excitement, but I imagine the Cambrian period, yeah, things are quite small. They're not moving super quickly, but I think there's a lot of beauty and a lot of the organisms that are there, there's a lot of very slender things with very soft appendages. Yeah, I can just imagine just sort of sitting back with maybe some tranquil meditative music and just watching everything swish by. And occasionally maybe you'll get a high-speed anomalous caris whizzing around and disturbing the peace. But I think there's an awful lot of beauty there to be observed. If I had to single one animal out, I'm a big fan of Hallucigenia, which is about the size of a fingernail. It's like a tiny little hockey stick with lots of little spines on the back. But it's got these enormous long filamentous appendages that, yeah, sort of wafted around, maybe collecting food particles, you know, sort of cruising up and down the sponges. And there's just something about the fineness of it. It's sort of got detail down to the microscopic level. And there's a real grace and beauty there that it's sort of hard to see today. Maybe because things that look that graceful and beautiful get swallowed up very quickly by some passing predator. So, yeah, enjoy the details, I think. And it's amazing how if you get these animals under the microscope today, you can really pick up these really fine, delicate structures that, yeah, you completely miss with the naked eye. And there's so much hidden there. There's layer upon layer of unfamiliar and remarkable stuff to enjoy.
And what about you, Xiaoya?
Yeah, that's a really difficult one. If there's a time machine as a dream come true and we can dive into the Cambrian community, as I mentioned, I don't want anywhere too close to Anne Paris. I don't want to be bite. And for my personal research interest, Lobopodian is one of the major groups I studied. And I would really, really like to see some of these early Lobopodians and how they use their earliest leg on the earth to walk around, swimming around, climbing around. And of course, I like to see the action in front of my eyes, all these amazing predators and the interaction between different group animals. Also, I want to see their color.
Yes.
I want to see what color they are. That's the most difficult bit. Yeah.
Yeah, because some velvet worms are beautiful colors, aren't they?
They are, yeah.
And there's no reason to assume that they weren't 500 million years ago.
Yeah.
And all that's left for me to say is thank you very much to my two guests, Dr. Martin Smith and Dr. Xiaoya Ma, for guiding me through the Cambrian. If you've enjoyed what we've been talking about today, then make sure to check out their research, because if you couldn't tell, it's really, really fascinating. There are links in the episode notes. Last but by no means least, thank you to you for listening. I hope you've enjoyed this episode, and if you have, please feel free to like, subscribe, share, and leave a positive review. And I hope you'll join me again for another episode of The Backpacker's Guide to Prehistory. But until then, safe travels.